If I only have one wish this Christmas, it would be to hear the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. A Medicare podcast that barks up the right tree every time. And now, practicing bird calls under the spreading chestnut tree, it's Medicare expert Doug Jones.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. We are cruising right along here, gaining audience at a rapid rate. And so I'm going to give a little bit of a report in just a few minutes. But first, I want to introduce our announcer that opens every episode. That is my Canadian nephew, Drew McMillan. I don't know what he said today, but I'm pretty sure it was very complimentary. He and I are very close. Mother is one of my favorite sisters, and the Canadian line, the Canadian and U.S. border that separates us is basically in our imagination. I mean, he's still a valued part of the family, and we're trying to figure out how to get them, the Canadian relatives, which involves seven people, holy crap, they're growing as we speak. That would be Drew, his bride, his daughter Nora, who is brand new, his mother and father, and then his brother and sister. And there may be hangers-on in those people's lives, too, that I don't know about yet. But trying to get them all down to Laguna Niguel, California, for Thanksgiving. And if that works out, it'll be a miracle. And we got people coming from Texas. And then, of course, Mary and I will be coming from Arizona. So keep your fingers crossed that we have a Thanksgiving this year in California, in spite of the political turmoil going on there. So anyway, that is Drew McMillan's life. Lazy Man. Why are we calling this a Lazy Man podcast towards the Lazy Man? It's a Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. And that's because there are certain people out there who are approaching Medicare age. They know they have to make decisions. They shrink away. They shy away from making those decisions because, frankly, they're scary and they're boring. Those two things, there's nothing exciting about Medicare, and it's kind of scary for people to have to become experts. Well, that's why you have me. I can become your expert. I can help you do the decision process. When your decisions are made, I can help you do the paperwork, and I can get all of this stuff done without any pain or angst on your part. So you would be the lazy man if you are reluctant to become a Medicare expert. I would be the Medicare expert that Drew McMillan was talking about when he opened this episode of the podcast. So that's why we're here. Now, we've got another player in this bunch, Randy Carson, who is a knob twister and a slide slider. And he often plays our 30-second radio spot that we developed last year. It's a very succinct way of describing why we're here. So I would say, if Randy can play that right now, I'm just going to be quiet and let it play, and then you'll know a lot more than you know right now.
Medicare is complicated. Medicare can be confusing. Medicare is no fun to study. Will you know what decisions to make when Medicare time arrives for you? My name is Doug Jones, and I wrote a book to help you figure it all out. Medicare for the Lazy Man. It's on sale at Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. Also, you can download and listen to my podcast, Medicare for the Lazy Man, wherever fine podcasts are given away free of charge. Medicare for the Lazy Man, simplest and easiest guide ever.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you. So that's the succinct version of what we're doing here. Now, Randy should join us because his contribution to our understanding of Medicare is absolutely critical. Hello, Randy.
Doug, you're looking particularly scholarly today.
Well, thank you. That's because I have my glasses on, my $5 drugstore glasses.
$5. Yeah. I go to the dime store.
Yeah, you know the better places to get them. There's no place in Illinois you can get anything for under $5, let me tell you.
Go ahead.
I can't wait to get back to Arizona.
I go to Costco and I get them by the gross for like $20.
Do they make you wear a mask in there?
I haven't been in there lately, so I really can't answer that question.
Well, Pugsley, the Illinois governor, tried to institute a new mask mandate, and I can see that this one is not being adhered to as strictly as the last one was. I've been in a Napa auto parts store a couple of times, and the first time I argued with them, and they gave up in the middle of the argument, said, okay, just what do you want to buy? And then the second time I went in, they didn't even say anything. So I'm thinking that Pugsley is going to lose out on his mask mandate. I've been to restaurants where even the servers aren't wearing masks and nobody seems to care. So I'm thinking that Pugsley has played out his cards, played out his
Pugsley is losing out. Hey, I got a question for you. Well, I got some news to tell the folks in the audience, and then I've got a question for you.
Already,
what does your T-shirt say? I can't see the whole thing.
This was a gift from my daughter-in-law, and it's, you know, in a factory where they have the big sign that says how many days it's been since a lost time accident.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this shirt says it's been 0 days since sarcasm.
I love it.
I feel a little funny in it because it's not symmetrical. Usually when you wear a T-shirt, it's generally symmetrical, or else you have a medallion size thing on one side or the other. And this one, I feel odd in because it's asymmetrical. But
yeah, I was going to say, is it making your right arm feel a little heavier with that big zero?
I'll tell you what makes my right arm feel heavy. That is, a friend of mine came over at 11 o'clock Sunday morning, and we worked in the garage all day until it was cocktail time, which came earlier that day. But about 5 hours of changing the fuel pump on Mary's 1950 Jeepster over and over and over again, probably had to put it on 3 or 4 times. It was just incredible. We finally gave up and I ordered a new fuel pump. We took that thing off. We put it back on. We took it off. Anybody that's ever worked on the fuel pump on a Chevy engine, an old school Chevy engine, knows that it's one of the stupidest designs. But, you know, it may be that Fords are the same and Mopars are the same, but it's just incredibly stupid. And we had so much trouble that I finally gave up and just went out and bought a new one, thinking that, okay, rebuilding it. This was a new one we were putting on, but we accidentally didn't do something right and it wouldn't pump anymore. And just, it was a nightmare. So that's what makes my back was so pained from bending over the fender of this car and working. Basically, it was like bending over, tying my shoes and untying my shoes for 5 hours. It was completely weird.
Just like kindergarten again.
Yeah, only not as fun. I didn't have a little rug I could stretch out and go to sleep on.
That's right. That's right. Hey, I got another question for you. It's with great sadness that I noticed on the internet the other day that Chevy has decided to quit manufacturing their, I forget what model it is. It's like a seven out of the box, 775 horsepower V8, like a Z something or other. And
yeah, I think they're just still on the tree huggers yet. I don't think
they really maybe we could still get one then.
Well, here's the deal. The people that really buy a lot of Chevy engines have the wherewithal to manufacture them if Chevy ever stops making them. There are millions of crate engines out there, and I don't know if Chevy's making them all or if other companies are doing it. I have friends who started a race car engine building company back in the day, in the probably late 60s, early 70s, and they're still cooking. What they have now is they've got a couple of these CNC machines, and yeah, they just put a big block. Now, this is for special types of engines. They sell them. They're for Japanese cars that race only, and they sell them to a company that's not too far from here. I don't know what the name of the company is. They're not allowed to tell anybody that they're, because this company takes all the credit for having their own engines. But basically, they just take a big hunk of aluminum, put it in the CNC machine, turn it on, walk away, and at the end of the day, they've got an engine block, and these things are fast. I believe that other companies will step in where Chevy is giving up the manufacturing process, and we won't be without Chevy engines for as long as we want them.
I got a question. When you get out here for the winter, do you think that we could cram one of those 775 horsepower V8s in my Wrangler?
Oh, yeah. And it probably wouldn't take much cramming. We might not even need a really big crowbar because they're managing to squeeze more horsepower out of a smaller package than they used to. So I'd say let's give it a try.
Let's give it a shot. And we can do that. And because that's my Wrangler, I could also put a blower on it. Given Mary won't let me put a blower on hers.
It's not that she doesn't want the blower. It's that she doesn't want the big hole in the hood.
No. So it's an aesthetic thing.
Yes. Yes. She loves that, that 65 Corvette line, that gentle.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. What year is your Jeep?
It is a 2002.
Okay. Is the state of Arizona going to come after you for some smog control?
You know, I don't know. I'll have to check that. I don't really know whether I've got a smog system on that or not.
Because if they do, well, I think, I would like to think that they're not going to, because I hate government intrusion in my private business. But if they're going to hold you to certain emission standards, then you might have to actually move up to Flagstaff or, Sedona or someplace. And air quotes.
And if I had a 775 horsepower engine in my Wrangler, I would be going to Flagstaff now.
No, you'd get there in very short order. By the way, I did tell the audience at the outset of this episode that we had noticed a big bump in audience downloads. It was, and so I went to the statistics section of our podcast host, I guess you'd call it, and we, as usual, have the vast majority of our downloads are people that are listening from the United States, and a somewhat smaller population in Canada. But let me read off the other countries where people are listening to this podcast. When Randy and I work our magic, it turns out it has worldwide appeal. So in order of their downloads, it's the Dominican Republic, Brazil, Russia. Now here's a place I've never heard of, Anguilla. Anguilla. It sounds like it should be a Caribbean island, but I just don't know for sure. India, Kuwait, Norway, the Philippines, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia. So that's where people have been listening to this podcast. Doesn't that make you feel good, Randy?
We're international.
We're international. We appeal to peoples from all walks of life.
That's right. I agree. They should.
You had something to announce too. What might that be?
Oh, I'm painting my house. You know, I told you early on, we decided to paint our house. And because of that, I had to turn off all of my security cameras. Otherwise, they were going to drive me nuts. And guess what happened just right off the get-go?
Oh, God, don't tell me one of those sales dudes got to you.
A Medicare Advantage guy snuck in and got me.
Well, we are very close to AEP, and that's when those people go completely berserk. So
I know.
They're going to be trying harder to penetrate your defenses from between October 15th and December 7th is AEP. And that's why people are going to start getting more and more mail than they've ever gotten in their lives, and more phone calls, even though the government says that's verboten, and why guys are going to try to sneak into your secure compound there. When your alarms are off, you better turn those alarms back on. Just let the painters set them off.
No, I know. And this guy was actually going the extra mile because he disguised himself as a painter.
Jeez, that's going the extra mile and then some. That is really that must be somebody new. Remember, we read about what you're supposed to do when you're new in the business. Make sure that you take a bubble bath the night before.
Make sure you wash your face. Be sure you brush your teeth. Be on time. What else weren't we supposed to do?
You have to have two GPSs in case one breaks or something.
Yeah, that's right. Just in case one breaks and you miss your appointment. Oh, my God. I mean, I just don't even want to think about it.
Well, I don't blame you. So let's think about something else having to do with Medicare today. It's been kind of desk cleaning for me. I know someday I'm going to have to move. Someday I'm going to sell this house. God knows when, but someday. So I collected some articles that I collectively described to Randy earlier as articles from the No Poop Sherlock Department. I didn't say poop. I said a different word, but no poop Sherlock is an apt description. And one of these articles I'm holding in my hand, the headline of which is, how would drug price negotiations affect Medicare Part D premiums? Now, what they're talking about here is allowing the federal government to, and I'm going to use air quotes, negotiate prescription drug prices. Now, they have a House bill, H.R. 3, which is named the Elijah E. Cummings Lower Costs Now Act. This bill aims to lower out-of-pocket drug costs for Medicare beneficiaries and private plan enrollees and achieve savings for Medicare. The debate over a budget reconciliation package in the coming weeks and possibly months is likely to focus heavily on the savings to Medicare, which can be used to expand Medicare benefits and fund other health priorities. However, by lowering Medicare spending for Part D, which is Medicare drug plans, standalone drug plans, that covers retail prescription drugs, drug price negotiation proposals would also be expected to lower premiums that beneficiaries pay for Part D coverage. So in other words, if you have a regular Medicare Parts A and B, and you have possibly a Medicare supplement, and you purchase a standalone Part D drug plan, they're saying that if we allow the federal government to negotiate the prices of drugs with the drug companies, this will have an effect on the price you pay for a Part D prescription drug plan. So, and the reason people have to buy that is because if they don't buy it when they're eligible, and if they wait to purchase a Part D drug plan when they need it, then they're going to wind up paying a lifetime late enrollment penalty. So there are a lot of people purchasing a Part D drug plan when they turn 65 that don't need it because they don't take any drugs, but they're doing it to stave off that lifetime late enrollment penalty. Anyway, according to an analysis by Medicare actuaries of the version of the House bill that passed the House of Representatives in the 116th Congress, I don't know any Congress numbers. I don't know what number we're on now. I don't know when the 116th Congress was, but this article was written last month. So maybe the 116th Congress is still going on. Anyway, the drug price negotiation provisions in the legislation would reduce spending by Medicare Part D enrollees by $117 billion over 10 years. Okay, so that's like $11.7 billion a year. Ugh. A reduction of $102.6 billion in cost sharing for people who use drugs covered under these plans that are subject to negotiation, and another $14.3 billion reduction in premiums in addition to Medicare savings. This data note estimates, what the heck does that mean? Average premium savings attributable to the negotiations of provisions of the H.R. 3 legislation on a per capita basis for Part D enrollees who pay the premiums, including those receiving partial low-income subsidies in dollar amounts and as a share of the base. Boy, this is the most awkwardly worded sentence I've ever read in my life. There's no period at the end of this thing. It goes on and on and on. But it does have the word actuaries in it. So that's how I know that it was written by mathematicians, not English majors. So it goes on to say, how does drug price negotiation affect Part D premiums? Under Part D, beneficiary premiums are calculated to cover 25.5% of the costs for standard coverage, which includes benefit payments before catastrophic coverage threshold, as well as catastrophic costs, i.e. reinsurance. Allowing the federal government to negotiate drug prices is expected to result in lower prices for those drugs subject to negotiation, which would lower Medicare spending for the standard drug benefit and lower Part D premiums, with significant reductions in reinsurance spending, i.e. costs above the catastrophic threshold. These reductions are expected to be somewhat offset by cost increases attributable to a reduction in rebates paid by drug manufacturers to Part D plans. Randy put on his glasses that have his wide open eyeballs painted on the glass because it's just to look like he's paying attention. He's shaking his head like, okay, we're losing the audience. I think he can tell he's got a gauge or something that tells him how many people are actually listening. And that number is getting smaller and smaller. And I don't blame him. Here's the point. I'm not even going to read the rest of this article. I wanted to read something that would make clear the case for allowing the federal government to negotiate. And then I wanted to say, well, here is the real truth. The federal government does not negotiate drug prices. If this House bill becomes law, meaning the Senate has to pass it too, the U.S. government will not negotiate anything. They will dictate. They will demand that the price that they want to pay will be what the drug companies must charge for their drugs. And frankly, that is a really, really bad idea, because what happens is drug companies are forced to spend so much money to bring a new drug to market that they have to go, and they have such a limited time to make up that money, that they have to amortize the cost of that research across all of their product lines. So the fact that we might pay a ton of money for aspirin is only controlled by competition, because there are so many companies making aspirin that one company that's charging too much for aspirin isn't going to sell much aspirin. So the competition keeps prices in line. But while the drug companies have a patent on a particular drug, let's say, a vaccine that might protect people against, say, a virus, they have to recoup the costs of research and development that led to the ability of that company to make unlimited quantities of that vaccine. And if they don't recoup those costs, they're going to have to add the cost to the products that they sell that don't have anything to do with it. And frankly, if they can't recoup the cost in that manner, they're going to go broke, or they're going to refuse to do what they do best, which is develop new drugs, conduct the research that's needed to develop new drugs. So we're going to be sitting around without any drugs. And it's going to be the federal government's fault. And it's going to be the fault of people that vote for bills like this that don't understand economics. Those people don't have to go to work every day and research and develop new drugs and test them out and provide truckloads of research data to the federal government and then wait and wait and wait while the federal government plows through all that data. They have tractor trailer loads of printed data that has to be delivered to the FDA in order to test or validate the safety and efficacy of the drugs that they develop. And that's largely a function of thalidomide. Back in the 1960s, Randy and I have talked about this before, thalidomide was a huge tragedy for a lot of people. It was a drug that was brought over by business travelers from Europe, I think mostly from England, for pregnant women to allow them to not have morning sickness or allow them to sleep better. And it turned out it led to some very incredibly horrible birth defects on the unborn babies that these pregnant women had. So we have gone way too far in the other direction of villainizing the drug companies and interfering with their profit and loss activities. Profit is the motivator behind what they do. And if they close up shop because we've taken all the profit motive away because the federal government's going to dictate to them what they're going to charge for their product, then we will have shot ourselves in the foot. So when people tell you that drug companies are evil and they don't have the right to operate like other businesses do, which is to cover their overhead and make a reasonable profit, then you should tell those people to go fly a kite. And that's the most polite way I can think of to stop the flow of bad ideas from negatively affecting our well-being. And with that said, Randy, I'm guessing that you can take those glasses off now with the eyeballs painted on them. Are we anywhere close to quitting time?
Yes, it's coming up on the metaphorical 5 o'clock here at the Medicare for the Lazy Man. We are out of steam, we're out of gas, but we've got a few items of business that we need to take care of before we go.
Let's do that.
And I just love telling the folks on this particular podcast that, did you know what? Doug Jones is an insurance guy. Okay. He sells insurance.
That's also from the Department of No Poop Sherlock. I thought everybody would know that. And I talked to a gentleman this morning from New York, and he said, I read your book. And so then I turned 65 a few months ago, bought your book, read it. And he said, I just picked it up again to read it again. And I got to like page 3, and there it says in big print, I will be your insurance guy. And that's all I needed to hear. I didn't need to read any more. I just called you. So that was refreshing. But why don't other people know that? Why don't other people know I can be their agent?
Well, I think we've been somewhat remiss in the past of making that a point. We were talking about your excellent books and your excellent audio books and your Kindle books and all that stuff. And I don't know, we probably missed out on the idea that you actually sell insurance. But, I'm trying to bring that up to speed now, as you've noticed. I'm mentioning it a little more often. But so now everybody on this particular podcast knows that Doug can be your insurance guy. But you still need to go to Amazon.com and you need to buy some books, because without the book sales, Doug doesn't get any gas money for his Corvette.
Actually, the book sales are kind of a break-even proposition when you compare the cost of promotion with the cost of the royalties that they pay. But the book will allow people to understand my rationale. In other words, when I advise people as to where I think they ought to go with their Medicare coverages, if they've already read the book, which is like going to take maybe an hour, two stiff drinks maximum, then they will have a clear understanding of the reasons behind my recommendations. And that makes the whole process a lot easier and a lot less painful. If I have to start from scratch and tell everybody all about Medicare, it gets a little boring and a little dull.
We used to have a term in the software development industry called MEGO.
Yeah.
M-E-G-O.
Yeah.
Have you heard that one?
What is it?
It stands for my eyes glazed over.
Is that when you got the idea for the glasses with your eyeballs wide open?
Yes, I painted little eyeballs on here and it worked out real well. But
that's
I just wanted to. Yeah, I just got to tell you, folks, Doug is the real deal. Don't believe anything to the contrary. You have just spent about 32 and a half minutes with Doug Jones, the anti-insurance guy from Oklahoma and the newest and latest CEO of Medicare for the Lazy Man.com.
Bye-bye.